Apropos of nothing, I suppose. I want to talk about the poem "Howl" by Allen Ginsberg. I was recently asked to talk about it to an AP history class of some high school students up in Sacramento. I did it through Skype, and it was really fun. It's a poem I used to teach all the time. You know, so it was fun to sort of revisit. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I find that when I really feel something, I know an idea well, I sort of, it's inhabited me. I sometimes forget that maybe it's interesting to anybody else, right? To me, it just becomes part of the fabric of my existence. It becomes almost a habit. So it's fun to revisit it for this classroom and see, you know, it sort of brought it back to life to me, you know, the mere really talking about it. And so, you know, I thought maybe I'd share this with the world at large, you know. So Howl's a funny poem. I discovered Allen Ginsberg when I was in high school, you know, and I fancied myself, you know, a hippie and, you know, I had older siblings and, you know, it was mid-80s. And, yeah, I'm still sort of in this hippie thing. And I was also considering myself sort of a Marxist. I had a big poster of Marx on the wall. I also had some Grateful Dead posters on the wall. You know, I would read some of Ginsberg's poems. Again, I'm not quite sure how I came across them, but it makes sense. There was some overlap there. And I read them quite seriously. You know, I really loved America. You know, America, America, go fuck yourself with your atom bomb. And I was never a big fan of Howl for some reason. And years later, or not, you know, when I was in college, I saw Ginsberg read several times. It was even propositioned. Well, a group of me and a bunch of boys propositioned by him. You know, the minute I saw him read, I really began to understand his humor, right? And the subtlety of the tone when I was reading it in high school rather stridently, rather seriously, despite the glaring humor. I wanted to be strident. I felt sanctimonious. I felt righteous, right? It is a trap. It is a seduction. It is a temptation. Of those who tend towards an ideology to feel righteous, to feel, to be serious about it all. I missed all the humor in Ginsberg. Watching him read America was just fantastic. America, America, go fuck yourself with your atom bomb. I don't feel well. Leave me alone. I mean, it was just the complexity really came out to me. Then I was living out here in San Francisco. I was living in some communal group house up in Lower Haight. And for some reason, Howl was on the ground. I don't know. It probably wasn't my copy. I don't think I had my books out here yet, but I don't know. And for some reason, just on a whim, just because we do things like this when we're, you know, 22 years old, I started reading it out loud. There was no one around. It was just me. And I couldn't stop. I was sort of flabbergasted. The rhythm, the way, the demands it made of me, of my mouth and my breath, and the way it sort of rolled out of me. I suddenly had this fundamentally different read. I had this sort of reckoning. That if I'd ever read the poem as I had read, as I think and believe I'd been trained to read, I'd read it as for its sort of constitutive claims, for its content. I wanted to know, you know, what it says. And, you know, at the time, it felt like before my out loud reading of it, when I still thought it was this sort of declaration of facts, this relaying of information, you know, it felt, I don't know what the word is, I want to say indulgent or banal, right? Just some hipsters getting lit and fucking around the city. And I was like, okay, whatever. Then when I read it out loud, it totally shifted me, right? The mere my performing of it to myself, to the universe, shifted. And I suddenly was just flabbergasted by his language and by, just the rhythm, just what a fucking poet he is. The sort of convolutions and acrobatics of the mouth. And then that began to kind of interweave with the images, right? And all of a sudden, I found myself in this very different place than where I'd begun, where I'd first seen it as a kind of catalog of the best minds of my generation, destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry, fix-angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night. Rather than being this catalog or this description, the sort of exhaustive rhythm, right? The some commas, some indentations, and then these words just sort of tumbling with this sort of sumptuous, angular reverie and revelry sort of at the same time, this sort of almost hypnotic yet the opposite. As I was reckoning it over time, I began to realize it was sort of an incantation. It was an incantation that to read it became an exercise in and of itself. That, you know, if you push aside the content, just the rhythm of these words, the rhythm of the sound, this physical act was itself transformational. Of the reader, it's rhythm, it's mode, and it made me think of I grew up Jewish boy. I guess I'm still Jewish, although I don't know what that means other than my big nose and my obnoxious verbal inflections and gesticulations when I speak. I have no religious affiliation whatsoever. Although I was bar mitzvahed, and we did go to synagogue. And I'm not even quite sure why. I think what community, we just moved to the small town, just north of Manhattan, and my mom didn't know anybody. Anyway, again, it was a very reform synagogue. But still, I would see sometimes the old man or the cantor davening. Right, davening is when you see these old Jews in their prayer and their beards, and they kind of rock back and forth, a sort of rhythmic, a physical pulsing to the prayer as they're sort of making their way through it. Yishkada, yishkada, shmeraba, and their bodies are rocking. And I began to, over time, begin to understand the performative nature of language, the way language works us over. So much of our training around language, the way we're taught to read, the way we're taught to write, is for its declarative content, right? That language states the conditions, right? It is raining, I feel X and X, may I please have the salt? We don't ever take a concerted look, concerted consideration of the performative nature of language, right? The things that language does in the very act of saying. That was, when I was teaching back at Cal, that was the number one thing I had to teach. I had to teach the performative nature of language, because without that, I couldn't teach anything else, right? I had to teach this way of reading, because otherwise how could I teach a book? If I want to read an essay or a book, whatever, for a subject matter, how can I even do that if we haven't talked about what it is to read anything? And I realized, quickly that students did not know how to read. People in general don't know how to read, that they still go to the content, to the declarative claims, to language as representational, language as a medium, right? It transports information in its sound and its inscription. And then it's the information that matters. But you know, in prayer and in watching these old Jews daven. I don't know why they're all old, but in my mind they're always old. This rocking, and this utterance of prayer, that there is this other thing happening, this transportive, this transformational, this sort of incantation, you know. And this made me think of, over time, of magicians and abracadabra, the saying of words that enact something, the mere saying. You know, the British philosopher John Austin, J.L. Austin, wrote a book called How to Do Things with Words, in which he coins this word, the performative, as a sort of function, operation of language. And at the beginning of the book, he sort of lays out the what he calls the explicit performatives, the examples where the saying of something is the doing. So, for instance, when you get married, you know, when do you take this, you know, guy to be your lawfully wedded husband, and the woman says, "I do." She's not describing getting married, right? The mere act of saying "I do" is in and of itself the act of getting married. Another example Austin uses is a bet. "I bet you. I bet you the Yankees are going to win." You know, I grew up a Yankee fan in New York. "I bet you," right? I'm not describing the bet. The mere act of saying "I bet you," and the other person says, "Yes, I bet you," the bet has been made, right? The saying is the doing. It is the performance of an action, hence the performative. I think the other example Austin gives is like christening a ship. You know, you break the champagne bottle and you say, I christen thee, you know, whatever the fuck you're calling that boat. And that, again, that the saying of it is the doing of it. And as Austin makes his way through his book, you know, the line between what he calls the performative and the constative nature of language, the proffering of statements of fact, or statements of states of being, the line between that and the performative, the actual actions enacted or performed by language, begins to blur. And there's all kinds of implicit performatives. There's all kinds of things language does in the act of saying. I think it's in Thousand Plateaus. I don't remember exactly where it is. Deleuze and Guattari talk about order words. And the use of the declaration guilty in a courtroom that enacts this elaborate, you know, social dynamic shift, right? I mean, bodies are incarcerated, your status in society changes the way people look at you. All these things happen in the declaration of this word guilty. But then you think about all the other things language does, right? The way it works you over. Right? In a very explicit sense, you know, me speaking here, these words, these aren't my words, right? I'm partially choosing these words, but they're partially choosing me, and I am following its rules. I'm following its codes. I am on the train of these words, in this grammar, in this mode of making sense. It performatively, language coerces behavior. It is a kind of dictatorial choreography. It's also quite generous choreography, in that you can do an infinite number of things with language. An infinite number, right? Within this closed set, you can do an infinite number of things. It's language is what I call a bound infinity, a constant state of emergence, of relentless combination and recombinatory possibilities. But you know, it's more explicit, perhaps, or more immediately explicit when you're reading, and you know, you watch somebody read, you watch yourself reading, you're following these letters, your body is moving, your eyes are moving, you're tracking, it is literally moving you. And that's in the sort of most sort of banal, explicit, physical sense. But then it's also moving you emotionally. As you make your way through any given text, any essay, poem, text from somebody, you know, it's funny, the word text is, means these different things today in and outside the academy. But you are moved, right? There's a, there's a whole choreography of affective or emotional states. So you might or might not be being informed of something or told a certain state of affairs, right? For instance, in the beginning of Howl, Allen Ginsberg says, "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness." Okay, Alan, you know, you told me something. I know now that I, whoever this I is, it's one of the trickier things about language, somebody saw something happened, right? He's making a claim, and then it's going to continue going on. But in the utterance of that phrase, "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving hysterical naked," there is a certain emotional affect, there's a certain poignancy, there's a certain longing, there's a certain anger, there's a certain joy, there's a certain resentment, there's a certain celebration, all sort of happening at once. Meanwhile, my body is getting worked over, right? "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving hysterical naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz," and it keeps going. It's even hard for me to read here out loud because it exhausts my breath, right? It's making a lot of demands of me. It is working me over the way all language works us over to a greater or lesser degree. You know, most of the time, most of the time we read it for its information or for its little affect, you know, a little sweet joke from somebody, even an emoji. I love emojis. I love text language quite a bit. Even if I don't like it at the expense of more elaborate purple prose. But I like it for its own internal pithy logics and its own kind of poetry and its own wit, you know. Although I still write lengthy text and paragraph breaks and things like that, but only because I enjoy it, not because I think text shorthand or the new texties, I don't consider it shorthand. It's its own dialect. I think there's beauty there. Even if I don't know how to speak that dialect. So here you have this poem Howl, who at one level it is declaring a sort of state of a generation, right? It is, and maybe that's what bugged me when I was a kid. It just seemed like it was, self-aggrandizing this generation. Something that at the time just felt forced and sort of unnecessary to me, but over time, I love the way Ginsberg kind of created this movement. I mean, he sort of invented it and said it's a movement and called them the best minds of the generation. And he created a movement. It's something we could all probably do with now, these sort of, you know, an impossibly cool movement. So, you have this poem, Howl, that, you know, I went from first reading for its constitutive claims, found it sort of wanting as a 16-year-old, and then, you know, as a 22-year-old reading it out loud and actually beginning to feel this strange rhythm, and then, you know, soon after that I was teaching critical writing and composition at UC Berkeley. It's how they would pay us. Public schools, public universities don't really have a lot of money in the humanities to fund their students the way they do at private schools. But we had teaching in the rhetoric department. So all through my graduate time, you know, we taught writing classes. And they were fantastic. There's nothing more powerful or intimate teaching somebody to write, because to teach them to write, you have to teach them to read, teach them to think, to organize thought, to have a whole relationship to language and texts. I mean, what is more profound than that? And in fact, when I was later teaching sort of upper level classes, on more subject matters, although they were strange subject matters. And when I was teaching I taught graduate seminars at the San Francisco Art Institute. And, you know, there was these classes in various aspects of critical theory. I got to teach a class called Joy and Complexity. Another class called the Postmodern. Those were kind of fun classes. Or What is Style? That was a cool class. And I theoretically supposed to assign these artists writing. I was supposed to write papers for me, but I didn't have the time to teach them how to read and write. Simply wasn't, you know, they needed to have already done that. So I rather I assigned them art. They had to make art. They're artists, you know. You know, it's always been sort of a problem when if I want to teach a text, because how one reads a text has to be the sort of entree into the text. And so the performative is the key figure for me. Without the performative, without this understanding of all the ways the performative works, both in a physical sense, in an affective sense, in a social sense, the way it reorganizes bodies in space, and the way it works together with the constative, the declarative aspect of language. Without that basic understanding, it's very hard for me to carry on a conversation about text with people. And I'm still flabbergasted that these things aren't taught in our high schools and our middle schools. We teach some aspects of grammar now and again, but no focus on all the beautiful, strange things language does. You know, in our daily life, the way we interact with people, we are often heeding the performative, right? It's how we understand sarcasm. It's how, you know, we say, you know, my kid acts out in some certain way. I don't always take him at his word. I'm like, oh, he's upset about something else, right? I know that the language is serving a different kind of function than simply what he says. You're with your sweetie, and you say, you feeling all right? And he goes, yeah, I'm fine. You go, you really fine? Yeah, I'm fine. Is that person fine? Is he fine? Or did you read not just what he said, but how he said it? And of course you did. Of course you did. Without that how, you would never have any sort of emotional exchange with another human being. You certainly have no humor. You know, anyway. So the poem How. At this constative level, it's relating the sort of experience of alienation and angst and striving of those of a certain generation. And then it begins to sort of move between these images of so-called high and low, of the divine and the sort of urban mortal decay. You already heard it earlier on, right? So, you know, I'm going to read the line again because it's a great line, right? Who I saw the best minds of my generation, destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night, right? So angel-headed hipsters, you know, who are out in the street looking for junk, looking to find heroin, who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated, who passed through universities with radiant cool eyes hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedy among the scholars of war. So throughout this poem, throughout this relating of experience, there is this intermingling, this juxtaposition yet intermingling of the divine and the heavenly with the profane and the physical and the urban and the mortal, right? And on it goes, and again, when I was young, I read this as this sort of hubristic sort of aggrandizing, but over time, I began to understand that what Ginsberg is doing is not just relating these things. He's not just sort of celebrating them, but he is giving us an incantation. So the poem How is itself an incantation. It is itself a way of, in the very utterance of it, in the very reading, speaking engagement with it, the sensuality of it, the physicality, the way it moves our breath and our bodies and our minds and our hearts and our loins, is itself this thing that sort of transforms and elevates and transcends. That like the old Jews davening in synagogue, right? So they're saying, they're praying Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, and they are praising God, and as they rock their bodies and with the rhythm of this Hebrew, they are communing. They are communing with the divine. They are participating in the divine. It is not just in prayer, you're not just heralding God. You're not just like, hey, here, I want you to know these things. You are entering a kind of exchange, a kind of participation with divinity itself. And that, to me, is what Hal performs. So that in the reading of it, we ourselves become these beats wandering the streets looking for our fix, and in so doing we ourselves become transported. So rather than the poem relating or relaying these sort of states of affairs, these conditions of the best minds of his generation, we ourselves participate with them. We become them. We become with them. And, you know, as is, again, just on a purely aesthetic level, I mean, this poem is just gorgeous, just these lines and its rhythm. It seems to have a form, and it has a kind of refrain, right, of who lit cigarettes in boxcars, racketing through snow towards lonesome farms and Grandfather Night, who studied Plotinus, Poe, St. John of the Cross, telepathy, and Bob Kabbalah, because the cosmos instinctively vibrated at their feet in Kansas, who loaned it through the streets of Idaho, seeking visionary Indian angels who were visionary Indian angels. God, his rhythm has this refrain, who. But at the same time, it is not, you know, it's not iambic pentameter. We're not reading Chaucer or Shakespeare here. It's a much looser form. But to call it just free verse doesn't seem quite right to me either, because there is a structure. And one of the figures that keeps working its way constantly, descriptively through the poem is jazz. And so you have this poem performing this jazz incantation, jazz as that movement from the mortal physical into participating with and of the divine. So the poem has this kind of structure, like a jazz score, where there is a melody, but in and around that melody there is tremendous freedom, right? So it's not just straight up free jazz, right? Free jazz is you know, kind of this incredible thing that really is sublime, right? It's rarely beautiful, and it approaches the sublime, right? As close as I know you can get to chaos. In sound and music, you know, which is very hard to find chaos, right? Order will have its way, man. But Hal is not that. Hal is not free jazz. And just as I don't really want to call it free form per se, because it has a structure. You know, I think of Indian classical music too, and the raga, which has its structure, its melodic structure, and then in and around that, there's sort of infinite variations. Kind of like language, right? It has a structure. There is a grammar. There is a vocabulary, and yet, within this contained universe, there is an infinite number of possibilities. So, as you're reading through this poem and experiencing this kind of incantation and this kind of exhaustion of breath that kind of helps you transcend. The poem shifts towards the end of its first section, and I think begins naming itself, so that all of a sudden the constative aspect of language, the thing it's describing, the content of what it's saying, and its performative qualities, the things it's doing in its saying, begin to merge sort of one-to-one, right? So, and he's talking about all these people, and finally says, and who therefore ran through the icy streets, obsessed with a sudden flash of the alchemy of the use of the ellipse, the catalog, the meter, and the vibrating plane. That is this language, that the vibrating plane is the realm of meter and ellipse that he performs in the poem itself. The poem is the vibrating plane from the meter of language. The poem goes on. Who dreamt and made incarnate gaps in time and space through images juxtaposed and trapped the archangel of the soul between two visual images, enjoying the elemental verbs and set the noun and dash of consciousness together, jumping with sensation of pater omnipotens eterna deus. Right? So all this juxtaposition of these images of the angel-headed hipsters looking for their fix, he is now telling you, he's declaring what he's performing. Right, that he's not just telling you these things, but he's saying in this act of doing this, I've trapped the archangel of the soul between these visual images. And the verbs and nouns are the elemental verbs and the noun and dash of consciousness itself. These things are not describing consciousness. They're not describing the elemental vibrating plane of existence. They are of it. They are performing it. This is this plane. This is this participation in divinity. The poem continues. To recreate the syntax and measure of poor human prose and stand before you speechless and intelligent and shaking with shame, rejected yet confessing out the soul to conform to the rhythm of thought in his naked and endless head. That is the poem. The very thing that he's describing is the very thing he's performing. Right? This poor human prose standing before you, speechless and intelligent and shaking with shame, rejected yet confessing out the soul to conform to the rhythm of thought in his naked and endless head. The rhythm of thought. That if you so much of our writing is set to just sort of explain my ideas, to explain one's ideas, right? In Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, she blah, 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 blah. And it's a simply descriptive thing. Yes, my son is a freshman in San Francisco school, had to read The Lottery, which is fine. But now imagine not just explaining your idea, but having your writing conform to the rhythm of thought in your naked and endless head. We see this maybe in James Joyce, right? In Finnegan's Wake and in aspects of Ulysses. I think Clarice Lispector's Agua Viva, Stream of Life, is performed this quite explicitly. And not streams of consciousness per se. It's stranger than that. The poem continues. The madman, bum, and angel beat in time. So again, we get the madman, bum, and the angel. The madman, bum, and angel beat in time, unknown, yet putting down here what might be left to say in time come after death. Here, like the word I, and the word this, and the word now, are these incredible words because they always insist on the moment right then and there. Right? If so much of language is referential and it's pointing to other things such as the madman, bum, it could be that guy over there across the street. But the minute I say the madman, bum, and angel beat in time, unknown, yet putting down here what might be left to say in time come after death. Where's here? Right? Here only takes on significance in the very act of it being uttered, either written or spoken, right? The minute it's performed, it insists on itself. I have my one and only tattoo on my arm says this. All it says is this, THIS, because it's this insistence. This is always this. It doesn't refer to something else. The word dog refers to an idea of a dog, to an actual dog, to the memory of a dog. But the word here, like the word this now, and the word I, right? I in this poem is not Allen Ginsberg. So when it opens, it says, I saw the best minds of my generation. Well, I said it, so isn't I? The word I, like the word here, like the word now, like the word this, are a function. They are a performance. They, in fact, only take on a constant value in as much as they are performed. And they are a function of designation. So yes, they designate, but only in as much as they are functive, only as much as they are enacted. The madman Bum, an angel beat in time unknown, yet putting down here what might be left to say in time come after death, and rose reincarnate in the ghostly clothes of jazz, in the gold-horned shadow of the band, and blew the suffering of America's naked mind for love into an Eli Eli Lama Laba Sabachthani saxophone cry that shivered the cities down to the last radio. With the absolute heart of the poem of life, butchered out of their own bodies, good to eat 1,000 years. Woo! There is no punctuation in there, ma'am. That is just an incredible freaking passage. And that is the end of the first section of Howl. The absolute heart of the poem of life, butchered out of their own bodies. This is what this poem is. Howl is not a poem that describes the Beat Generation, although it also does that. It is a poem that performs the Beat Generation. And the argument that Ginsberg is making is that this generation, the Beat movement, is in itself this movement of accessing the divine through the flesh, of the flesh, elevating the flesh to the divine and vice versa. That it's not necessarily, I kept saying transcend, and there's a kind of transcendence, but more than transcendence, perhaps, there's a realization of the divine. So maybe transcending is a taking leave of the physical to access, you know, another plane. And that might be what's going on here. But it also, I think a better notion would be realization. So that in the very reading of this poem, I myself am beat. I myself am performing an incantation that has me participating with the divine. To read Howl is not to read about the beats, but it is to throw my flesh, right? To create the poem of life butchered out of my own body. Butchered out of my own body. Right? And so the ending, again, of that section has this constative, this declarative nature of language and its performative nature map one-to-one to each other, which sometimes is the case and sometimes not. It's neither a good nor bad thing. It's just interesting. The poem goes on. It has two sections, three sections. And then it has something called a footnote to Howl, which it's designated its own poem. Is one of my favorite things in the whole world. And I think it helps. It works as a nice companion, as a nice footnote to the poem. Holy, 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 holy. The world is holy, the soul is holy, the skin is holy, the nose is holy, the tongue and cock and hand and asshole holy. Everything is holy, everybody's holy, everywhere is holy, every day is in eternity, every man's an angel, the bum's as holy as the seraphim, the madness is holy as you, my soul, are holy. And on it goes, the typewriter is holy, the poem is holy, the voice is holy, the hearers are holy, the ecstasy is holy. That is, again, a great example of the constative, right? He's making an argument here about the nature of the holy, the nature of the divine. And that rather than there being this radical distinction between, you know, the flesh and mortality and the divine, he's saying they are all holy, right? And the poem itself has this sort of insistent celebratory kind of exuberant madness to it. This exclamation, holy, 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 holy. I'm not even sure I read enough holy, so it's hard to keep track. But that's Allen Ginsberg's Howl. It's good, man. It's a joy. I highly recommend just reading it out loud. Read it to yourself out loud. Just sit in your living room. Read it to your kids. And in your reading of it, see where it takes you, how it takes you. That's what I got to say.